This summer, have a safe one by learning your ABCs. A is for action plan. Having an action plan means you know what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. B is for be safe. Be aware of the hazards you may face in the local area. C is for connect. Connect with your community, your family, and the ABC. This summer, know your ABCs. For more, go to abc.net.au/emergency. During an emergency, for the most reliable and up-to-date information, listen to your local ABC radio station. ABC Radio is your emergency broadcaster.
From Wurundjeri country, I'm Lexi Junawick, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, Australia's gun laws are in the spotlight following the deadly Bondi terror attack, as the nation's leaders consider what changes need to be made to protect communities in the future. You'll hear from Home Affairs Minister Tony Burke.
The Howard government did a great thing with the restrictions following Port Arthur, and we all thought that that had done enough, that Australia was now immune. In the most horrific way we've seen, that's not true.
Then, Hong Kong media tycoon Jimmy Lai is facing the possibility of life in prison after being found guilty of conspiracy to collude with foreign forces and sedition against China. You'll hear expert analysis on what could come next for the 78-year-old.
He is considered one of probably no more than two or three Hong Kong democracy activists who are top-level enemies of the Chinese regime.
From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. State and territory leaders have agreed to strengthen Australia's gun laws in wake of the Bondi terror attack. On Sunday, a father and son opened fire on members of Australia's Jewish community at Bondi Beach, leaving 15 people dead. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has vowed to take whatever action is necessary to tackle anti-Semitism, but that's doing little to quash criticism that the government failed to adequately keep Jewish Australians safe. Host Melissa Clark spoke with Minister for Home Affairs, Tony Burke.
Could the federal government have done more to prevent this attack?
I think every Australian looks at something as horrific as what we've seen. You always ask that question. Your agencies are constantly reviewing, because your simple objective is you want people to be safe and to feel safe. I go through the different work that the security agencies do, our security, intelligence and law enforcement agencies do absolutely extraordinary work. And I've seen some of the criticism that's been in the media. I have to say the work of our agencies is second to none, and they are as horrified as anyone.
We know that one family member's previously been investigated by ASIO. We know another family member has a significant gun collection. Is there a structural question here that might help improve efforts to prevent attacks like this in the future?
There's certainly issues in terms of connecting intelligence that we might have to gun licences. And you've raised there it not only going to the individual, but potentially going to other family members. And those issues, using criminal intelligence to underpin the licensing of firearms, is one of the things that National Cabinet agreed to work on yesterday. The Howard government did a great thing with the restrictions following Port Arthur, and we all thought that that had done enough, that Australia was now immune. In the most horrific way we've seen, that's not true. And so to make sure that we use all the tools available to us with respect to firearms is absolutely essential. And the one that you've described there, where some information was intelligence, it was actually a different person who had the firearms license. The issue of can you bring those together is one of the things that National Cabinet decided needed to be brought up to date yesterday.
National Cabinet seemed to also agree to look at options for things like limiting the number of guns an individual can own and limiting gun ownership to citizens, for example. Are they things that will definitely happen, or is this something that the states and territories are going to go away and consider but might not be implemented?
These laws are largely held at a state and territory level, but I have to say there is extraordinary goodwill around the table. I'm very confident we go on a pathway now to having much stronger firearms rules than we've had. Not all of your listeners will be familiar with Bonnyrigg, but anyone in Sydney who knows that suburb is shaking their head at how on earth could there be a reason for someone in Bonnyrigg to have that number of high-powered weapons. Like, it just makes no sense. And similarly, the concept of you might qualify for a gun licence at the point of your original application, but how regularly should that be fully reassessed and make sure that the up-to-date information is being plugged back into the system? So I've got a good level of confidence about the states and territories with respect to this. They'll lead the work.
Are hunting clubs being misused here by people who want to collect weapons, because we see people join clubs as part of their process of getting a gun licence? Does there need to be a tighter focus on the operation of hunting clubs?
I think there'll be a tighter focus around the lot. And, yeah, obviously there will always be some Australians where having a firearm is part of their work and is part of their management of their property. Like, that's always going to be the case. But making sure that we can better draw that line, and with the gun laws following Port Arthur, Australians and much of the world thought we'd drawn that line tougher than most of the world and more effectively than most of the world. We need to go through that process again.
Part of those Port Arthur reforms were setting up a national firearms register that's still in the process of being set up. I gather the current aim is to have that fully operational by 2028. How much quicker could you get to the point of having a fully functional national firearms register?
Yeah, I've been dealing with the Criminal Intelligence Commission on this one since it was brought to my portfolio after the election. The Criminal Intelligence Commission is in charge of bringing this together. Effectively, some of the states still had paper-based systems. What we are doing at pace now is getting the Commonwealth structure effectively ready that the states can all plug into. That date that you give would be the end date, effectively, but what I'm wanting to see is that we can get the Commonwealth part of it up and running as soon as we possibly can, so that infrastructure is there, that the states can start sharing their information.
What's as soon as you possibly can? What sort of time frame are we talking?
It is difficult to get the Commonwealth part of it done before we get to the second half of next year. Okay, so you're looking at this time next year before the Commonwealth part of it is likely to be finished. That is the time that they need to be able to set this up properly. Obviously, as you say, this is a recommendation from a very long time ago. We're now pressing the accelerator as fast as we can.
When it comes to the two gunmen, the pair were believed to have visited the Philippines just weeks before the attack. Now, we know that the Philippines is an area where extremist groups are known to operate and that others, foreigners, travel to the Philippines for training there. Given that at least one of these two people was of interest to ASIO at some point in the past, did this not trigger some kind of alert? Is there a system to alert ASIO when people previously of interest travel to countries where there is a history and record of extremist activity?
Can I just explain what ASIO have made clear? Because there's been some shifting in some of the commentary that's, I'm not saying you, but some of the commentary that's out there about person of interest and things like that. What we're talking about is one of the two, the younger of the two, came to ASIO's attention not because of anything that he had done, but because they were focusing on other people who he had associated with. The investigation of him was done, and it was determined at that point they did not have evidence of him reaching the threshold of being a person of interest himself. Now, that was a point in time more than half a decade ago. But since that time, there was a radical change in the risk profile of that individual. But the assessment that ASIO made more than half a decade ago was effectively where you have the people who you know you need to be concerned about, you do a check on anyone they might be associated with. That's a very large pool of people. That does not mean that back then this person was a person of interest in the way that's being described.
We spoke to Mark Dreyfus earlier in the program, who was the Attorney General overseeing the Commonwealth hate speech laws in the first term of the Albanese government. He said the government should be open to potentially strengthening those laws, noting that the states have stronger laws in this department. Would the Cabinet be willing to consider strengthening those laws?
Well, first of all, can I say I am glad the debate has now shifted to how do we strengthen hate speech laws? Because for about 10 years, the main debate that was happening in Australia was a whole lot of people, some very powerful people at the time, arguing that we needed to weaken them. And it needs to be accepted that words themselves are not without harm, not without risk, not without very real danger, and words themselves can find the pathway to the sorts of horrors that we saw on the weekend. What Mark Dreyfus has cast forward in terms of further protections against hate speech is something that the government does not stop looking at. Can I say, let's not miss what has more recently happened, including when Mark Dreyfus was Attorney General. We've now taken our hate speech laws to the toughest they have ever been in Australian history, with the hate speech laws advocating violence with very, very serious penalties. And also on top of that, things that are as impactful as speech, whether they be things like the Nazi salute or symbols of terrorist organisations or Nazi symbols, having the laws making it illegal for people to be knowingly using those. The first priority here has to be the safety of people. That's where it has to start.
Some in the opposition have said that the crucial issue in responding to this case is not gun laws, but immigration, given that one of the assailants was not an Australian citizen. Do you think immigration is a key issue here?
In terms of these two people, one was born here and is an Australian citizen. The other, not born here, but came here in 1998 as a student. So, there would be nothing in the immigration decisions that were made way back then by the Howard government, I suspect, that would have pointed to any level of risk about that individual way back then. So I don't think we can view this as an immigration issue. What we can say, though, is we always need to take very serious decisions about your security checks when people come to Australia.
Minister for Home Affairs, Tony Burke there. Staying with the government's response to the Bondi attack, and former Attorney General Mark Dreyfus says strengthening gun laws are a top priority, but he's also called for further action on other practical measures to tackle anti-Semitism on home soil. Mr. Dreyfus is the MP for the Melbourne seat of Isaacs and is a Jewish member of the government.
What we experienced on Sunday at Bondi was an extraordinarily distressing event for the Australian Jewish community. It was a distressing event for all Australians. I went to Bondi yesterday, and what I saw at Bondi yesterday was the real Australia. I didn't experience hatred at Bondi yesterday. What I heard was grief and love and compassion. And I heard people talking about the heroic police who ran to danger. And I'd like to mention Constable Scott Dyson and Constable Jack Hibbert, the two police who are still in hospital, for their heroism. People talked about the lifesavers who sheltered people on the beach and about the surfers who carried injured people on their boards. And people were talking about the thousands of Australians queuing for hours right across the country to donate blood. That's the Australian people. That's what's happening here. We've got the Australian people embracing the Jewish community, wrapping their arms around the Jewish community, but it has been an extraordinarily distressing event.
How do you marry that display of goodwill and support with the pain and the fear that is there for Jewish families today?
That's why the government has been saying so clearly that we need to do more, calling on everyone in the Australian community to unite. I know that this kind of act of hatred might be meant to divide us, but it will fail. It's failed before. the Australian people are going to unite to reject hatred. And that's what Jewish people can around Australia can see. It has been an appalling event. It's the much worse than anyone's worst nightmares. It's the event that we in the Jewish community feared, this murder of 15 of our community celebrating Hanukkah. It's unimaginable that it has happened, but it has happened. And Australians are rising to support the Jewish community, as indeed is the government. Of course we can do more. We will do more.
National Cabinet met yesterday afternoon and we've seen a signal of a move towards tougher gun laws. Is that the right priority for action at this point in time, in your view?
It's one of the things that we can do. It's obvious to people that having six guns, possibly rapid firing, in your possession is more than anyone could want. And so for National Cabinet to meet yesterday and say, right away, we think we should require citizenship to get a gun licence and we think there should be more limitations on the number of guns, they seem obvious reforms. We've got an agreement by National Cabinet, by the Premiers and the Prime Minister to strengthen Australia's already strict gun laws. And this is building on the work that I did as police minister, that the Prime Minister did in the last term, to implement a national firearms register across the country, something promised after the Port Arthur massacre back in 1996, which hadn't been achieved, but we achieved at the end of 2023. There's more to be done, but that's an example of not resting, not saying, oh, well, that's too hard, but saying it's not too hard. We're going to make these reforms. We're going to keep acting to make our already strict gun laws even stricter. And I think that's apparent to all Australians.
Some in the opposition have said that a crucial issue in this case is not gun laws, but immigration, given that one of the assailants was not an Australian citizen. Do you think that immigration is a key issue in this?
I think that we should resist quick answers like that, or I'd take a lot of convincing to say immigration. I don't even know what people are saying there. I think that we should be looking more at what further steps we can take with the settings in our criminal law. In the last term, we criminalised doxing, we criminalised the Nazi salute, we toughened our hate speech laws. We gave massive increases in funding for Jewish community security. These are all practical measures, direct measures, that are worth considering. We've now got Gillian Siegel's report, some of which is already underway, which is work with universities, work with schools on curriculum to deal with anti-Semitism. Because the one thing that is absolutely clear is that we've got to resolutely turn our face against Jew hatred and anti-Semitism.
Former Labor Attorney General Mark Dreyfus there. The scale of the Bondi tragedy is reminiscent of the Port Arthur shooting in 1996 in Tasmania, when 35 people were killed by a lone gunman. Walter Miak lost his two girls in that attack and set up the Alana and Madeline Foundation in their honour to campaign for keeping kids safe and stronger gun laws. Well, with gun reform now once again front and centre, Mel Clark spoke with Stephen Bendel. He's the Senior Advocacy Advisor at the Alana and Madeline Foundation.
Do you think the options that are being looked at by the state and territory governments, like curbing open-ended licensing, like limiting the number of firearms someone can own and restricting gun licences to Australian citizens, are they the kind of changes you think could make a difference?
Well, I think they could make a difference, and we're really pleased that those things are on the table. Interestingly, I'd be interested whether your listeners would be surprised that those things aren't already in our firearms agreement. They all seem to be reasonable things that the community would expect our governments to, you know, have in place. So they're the sort of things we need to address. But there are other things as well. I think we need to continue to push
around and push back against the firearm industry that have a commercial interest in the proliferation of, you know, firearms in Australia. So, for example, right now, a 13-year-old can't use Facebook, but they can go out and legally use firearm. Now, they need to be under the supervision of a firearm license holder, but that just seems to be, you know, a real paradox in how we're looking after children. Those sort of things need to be looked at.
We have seen certainly strong movement and lobbying by those who support hunting and want to make sure that they have a right to hunt and look at the laws that govern their ability to access and use firearms as they look to hunt. What influence does that lobbying process have on, and the wider gun lobby have on, governments as they consider where the balance should lie in access to guns?
The firearm industry has a huge commercial interest, as I said. They are very well resourced, very organised, and very influential. Until probably 5 years ago, when the Alana and Madeline Foundation were effectively forced into, you know, taking a stronger stand around firearms, firearm policy was entirely the domain of the firearm industry. We have one jurisdiction that has a firearm consultation committee that its requirements are representatives have to represent the firearm industry. Until recently, we had a jurisdiction that had a firearm act that entirely was focused around the administration and use of firearms. It only recently has changed to put community safety at the centre of its firearm laws. So these are the things that we need to look at.
Stephen Bendall, Senior Advisor at the Alana and Madeline Foundation. I'm going to take you overseas now, and Hong Kong media mogul Jimmy Lai could face life in jail after he was found guilty yesterday of conspiracy to collude with foreign forces and sedition against China. The 78-year-old founder of the now-closed Apple Daily newspaper will be sentenced in January after spending 5 years already in custody. Authorities in Beijing and Hong Kong maintain the trial was fair, but Western governments and human rights groups say the verdict undermines press freedom and judicial independence. For more on this, Mel spoke with Kevin Yam, a lawyer and former Hong Kong democracy advocate who's now a doctoral candidate at the Melbourne Law School.
Tell me about Jimmy Lai and what exactly he did that has led to him ending up in court.
So Jimmy Lai is a classic Hong Kong rags to riches story, a guy who came to Hong Kong as a teenager from China, then became a rich garments manufacturing tycoon, but then ended up having to sell his business for his pro-democracy stance even back in the early 90s. And then he set up the Apple Daily and another magazine, which was very much a Hong Kong pro-democracy anti-Chinese Communist Party publication. The thing he got convicted for came much later, which was around 2019-2020. As some might remember, Hong Kong had a huge protest movement against China's authoritarian rule. He campaigned for more democracy in Hong Kong. He campaigned for foreign governments to hold Hong Kong officials involved in any cracking down on Hong Kong's freedoms accountable for their actions. And for that, he's been convicted of colluding with foreign forces and for publishing materials through his Apple Daily newspaper that are considered seditious.
Jimmy Lai now faces sentencing and possibly life in prison. What are you expecting to happen in the sentencing process? Is there any chance he would avoid a prison sentence?
There is zero chance that he would avoid a prison sentence. He is considered one of probably no more than two or three Hong Kong democracy activists who are top-level enemies of the Chinese regime. So there is no doubt that he will face a lengthy prison sentence.
Is there anything that foreign governments can do to try to pressure authorities to undertake fairer judicial processes? Or is this now the state of law in Hong Kong that residents have no choice but to accept?
Unfortunately, this is where we are now with Hong Kong in terms of the legal system. There's the very vague national security law that Jimmy Lai has been convicted under. And whatever one might think about the judges themselves, the reality is that if the laws are going to be this capricious, there's not much they can do, even if they had goodwill. The reality is that in a case as high profile as Jimmy Lai's, all one can do is hope that Western governments can engage in some sort of negotiation with Beijing, similar to hostage diplomacy situations, where he might be let out on some medical grounds or what have you, and see how that goes.
Lawyer and former Hong Kong democracy advocate Kevin Yam. Well, that's about all we've got time for on The Breakfast Wrap today. Every interview was presented by Melissa Clark and produced by the Radio National Breakfast team. The Breakfast Wrap was produced by Michael Kermont. I'm Lexi Junowick. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll catch you the same time tomorrow.